we'd like to introduce two ladies who are just wonderful people, not only because they're top in their field and have written probably the best book out there on the market, but are also just really good friends of mine. And so I'm so happy that they had time to come in and join us today and share their knowledge and experience with you. Lilas G. Moak, M.D., is medical director and founding director of the Henry Ford Visual Rehabilitation and Research Center in Michigan. She's also chair of the American Academy of Ophthalmology Vision Rehabilitation Committee and Smart Sight Task Force, and she's been very effective in those two duties. She's a member of the American Medical Association Committee on Older Drivers. Inspired by her patients and by her father, who had advanced wet AMD, she co-authored with her daughter, Maria, the award-winning book for patients, families, and professionals, Macular Degeneration, The Complete Guide to Saving and Maximizing Your Sight. The other guest today is Maria Moak, who happens to be Lila's daughter. Maria is assistant professor of English at California Lutheran University at Thousand Oaks, California. She earned her undergraduate degree from the University of Michigan and her PhD from the University of California in Berkeley. Her areas of expertise include disability studies, contemporary Native American literature, and dramatic writing. She is the co-author of the book, Macular Degeneration, The Complete Guide to Saving and Maximizing Your Sight. I believe Lilas is going to take the first part of the presentation today, so we're going to go ahead and let her begin. I will turn over the microphone to her, and they're going to have me changing slides for them. So I'll sit back and enjoy right along with you. Lilas?
Good afternoon. We're very happy to be here, and we're honored to speak to Dan and all of you wonderful folks at MD Support. The title of our talk, With the Heart One Sees Rightly, is also the title of a chapter in the book that Dan mentioned. And we adapted this title from the famous line in The Little Prince, a novel about the nature of love and the value of life by the French aviator Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. You might recognize the original quote, which was, "It is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye." And these words reflect actually what we know about vision loss, that it isn't just about eyeballs. It happens to a whole person. And it's such a profound experience affecting one's life physically, functionally, socially, and emotionally that it challenges us to understand what we believe is at the heart of living fully. Next. Vision loss from macular degeneration can be particularly difficult because it is so often misunderstood by fully sighted family members, friends, and neighbors. And that's for several reasons. First, because we're used to thinking about sight exclusively in terms of visual acuity. If we have full sight, we say that we have 20/20 vision. But what we experience as sight is really a combination of a number of different elements, and visual acuity is only one of them. And actually, as an index of vision, acuity by itself is a red herring. Next. The other elements of vision are contrast sensitivity, glare, one's individual pattern of residual vision, depth perception, visual processing in the brain, and visual attention. Macular degeneration can impact the first five of these elements, which creates an experience of low vision that is difficult for others to understand. Next. The loss of contrast sensitivity, for example, the ability to see something against a similarly hued background, like these tan shoes on a tan carpeted stairway, is a major factor in AMD, and it accounts for a significant amount of functional vision loss. Next. Glare is also a big factor, like the streaks of light across the floor on the picture shown on the left of a hallway, and the variegated sunlight and shade in the picture on the right of a house and a lawn. Next. You can even have acuity as good as 20/40, but be unable to read if you have a ring scotoma, which means a blind spot kind of in the shape of a ring or a donut, so that the 20/40 vision is only in one small area, like in the whole of the donut, that's just big enough to see one letter at a time. Next. You can have 20/40 vision and be unable to drive for the same reason. The slide on the screen now shows a road scene as seen by someone with this pattern of donut-shaped scotoma. The driver can see the license plate of the car ahead, but not the rest of the car or other portions of the street around it. Next. About 20% of people with vision loss also experience Charles-Bonnet syndrome, in which they see images of people or animals or flowers or other scenes that they know are not there. And this slide shows a few of these pictures that are also in the book that people we know with macular degeneration have described. And they include little girls playing in a backyard, some Elizabethan figures all dressed up in fancy outfits, some flowering trees along the highway in Michigan in February, which certainly weren't there, and a red brick apartment building. Next. Most of all, if you have AMD, you don't look any different from other people. Your eyes look fine, you walk around pretty well, so others have a hard time believing that your vision is really having a major impact. And that can lead them to make assumptions like, oh, well, she just sees what she wants to see. Next. That's one of the reasons that vision loss is a new kind of loss in life, really unlike any other major loss. It comes without recognition, without flowers, and usually without strong community support. As one woman said to us, losing my vision is as if someone I love died and nobody came to the funeral. Next. Dealing with this kind of loss in isolation is a leading cause of depression with AMD, which happens to large numbers of strong individuals who don't have contact with a community like MD support. It happens to those facing social stigmas and to those who perceive the problem of vision loss itself as an individual isolated problem that is located only in oneself. Next. Depression is extremely common in AMD, and like the vision loss itself, it often goes unrecognized and misunderstood. In a study of depression among our patients with AMD, we found that fewer than 5% of those who tested as depressed had previously been diagnosed with depression by their primary care physicians. Why? Because especially among seniors, depression can be mistaken for aging. My senior patients with AMD, who may have brought up 6 kids without Dr. Spock or permanent press and either fought in World War II or worked in a factory during that time, will say to me, I just sleep all the time. I guess I'm just lazy. That's not laziness. That's depression. Depression is not weakness, not laziness, not a personal failure. Depression is a chemical and neurological, and it's a response to great loss in isolation, including vision loss. Next. The signs of depression include feeling apathetic, unmotivated, agitated, empty or numb, withdrawing socially, losing or gaining weight rapidly, experiencing emotional outbursts or swings of emotion, focusing on regrets, and experience a decrease in energy. Next. And depression is the enemy. You can learn to live fully with vision loss, but you cannot live fully with depression. Next. In order to lift depression, you have to address its causes: isolation, functional difficulties doing the things you want to do, a chemical imbalance in the brain that is triggered by these situations, and social pressure that makes you think you have to do things the way you always did them in order to be acceptable. And so to lift depression, allow yourself to be angry and grieve, and then choose to live fully. Join, reach out, remain active, get involved as you all are in MD support. Pursue as much vision rehabilitation as possible and bring your skills up. Learn how much you can do with proper training. Look for and be open to different ways to do the things you want to do. Take the risks that you might not get it right the first time or every time, and be straightforward with others about what you can and can't see. And as Dan said earlier, for other reasons, be sure to exercise. It helps reduce mild depression because it actually affects the chemical balance of your brain. And see a psychologist or a counselor and consider medication for depression if you or your doctor think that might be helpful. But most of all, keep your sense of humor and your faith. And I don't mean the kind of faith that just rubber stamps suffering. I was listening to the radio yesterday, and a woman with a severely autistic son was describing daily life caring for this child. She said, quote, "You know, people come up to me and say, God never gives us more than we can handle." And then she said, "I just want to kick those people in the shins." I don't mean the kind of faith that tells us that we just have to endure. I mean the kind of faith that reminds us how rich our lives are and can be, and how loved we are. The kind of faith that protects us from unnecessary anxiety. The kind of faith that lets us laugh from the belly and remember that we don't have to be perfect. We already are. It's with the heart that one sees rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. Next. Now, there's another kind of seeing or understanding that we need to do beyond understanding the different elements of vision, the causes of depression, and beyond seeing that our lives are not defined by vision alone. We need to understand how our cultural ideas of disability influence our views of ourselves and others. And this influence contributes to depression, too, and it affects our ability to see ourselves rightly. And Maria is going to take it from here. Next slide.
The second part of this talk comes from my dissertation in English and Disability Studies and from the work of Leonard J. Davis, who is a scholar in disability studies and the son of deaf parents. And the titles of those works are up on the screen right now. My dissertation is Narrating Vision, Disability, Aging, and Autobiography. And Leonard J. Davis's book is entitled Enforcing Normalcy, Disability, Deafness, and the Body. Next. Whenever I ask somebody what a disability is, I usually get an answer something like this. Disability refers to a physical injury or an abnormality that causes someone not to function as normal people do. Next. This understanding of disability is called the medical model because it focuses on physical impairment alone and therefore sees disability as located in an individual. It's all about what a person's body is like and how they can perform in comparison to what people think is normal. Next. The medical model of disability might sound like common sense, but it's actually a cultural viewpoint that's not universal. It comes out of our traditions of Western medicine that view health as an individual thing. It comes out of our history of a wage labor economy that sees people as economic units that must perform independently. It's also a definition that non-disabled people created. It doesn't really reflect the lived reality of people with impairments like vision loss. Next. To understand how disability is a culturally specific and culturally determined thing, let me give you three examples. First, we would say that a teenager with severe dyslexia has a disability. But what if he's living in a pre-literate culture in an Amazon rainforest where there are no books and nobody reads? Next. Or take this example. We would say that a little girl with severe epilepsy must certainly have a disability. But what if she's the child of a Hmong family in California? If you have read or listened to the wonderful book, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down, you'll know that among the Hmong people, epilepsy is a rare sign of spiritual gifts, and it's not something you really want to cure. They wouldn't view her as having a disability at all. Next. My third example is a young woman who is infertile. We would say that she doesn't really have a disability because infertility doesn't affect her capacity to work or to live independently. But what if she's from the Punan Ba people of Borneo? In her culture, infertility means that she is viewed as a malformed person who will never be accepted as an adult or achieve spiritual wholeness. That's a bigger disability than total blindness would be in her culture. Next. My point is that what we call disability is really a combination of people's cultural views the physical environment around us, and a physical impairment. Next. In other words, disability is not about a single person. It's a relationship between a person and the total environment in which we live. This is what's called the social model of disability. Next. What the social model allows us to understand is how the environment creates disability by shaping what any one of us can and can't do. For example, it helps us understand that if a woman with low vision from AMD goes to church on Sunday morning, her experience will be shaped not just by her vision itself, but by a number of other factors, like the print size of the hymnal, whether the stairs are clearly marked with contrasting color, or whether the lighting is sufficient, and also what the attitudes and assumptions are of the other people there, as well as her own view of herself. When you add all this up, the vision loss itself is only one factor among many that have among many others that have nothing to do with the woman herself, but that are still determining her experience of disability and shaping her what her Sunday morning turns out to be like at church. Next. The World Health Organization recognized the social nature of disability in 1983 when it recognized that a physical impairment is distinct from disability, which is what happens when someone with a physical impairment encounters an environment that makes functioning difficult, like a dimly lit restaurant. They also redefined a third term, handicap, to mean the discrimination that someone with an impairment might face socially and professionally. So, for example, we can think about AMD as an impairment. We can think about difficulty or an inability to read as a disability, and we can think about any discrimination that comes from that as a handicap, as those three things being very separate. Next. Unfortunately, when the World Health Organization went to write down their definition of these terms, impairment, disability, and handicap, they used another word that crops up a lot when we think of disability, the word normal. They wrote that impairment is a physical abnormality, that disability is an inability to perform an activity in a normal manner, and that a handicap is a social disadvantage that prevents an individual from fulfilling a normal role. So while these distinctions help us to understand that the problem of disability isn't about one person or isn't located in one person's body, it still puts the emphasis on whether or not something is normal. Next slide. I think we need to get a handle on this word normal and the way that it shapes our thinking. Normal, along with all of its cousins, abnormal, normality, and the norm, is a pretty new word in the English language. Until the 1840s, normal was strictly a carpentry term meaning perpendicular. Next. Then Sir Robert Galton, the father of modern statistics, borrowed it and redefined it for the bell curve, a new tool he was developing to rank and measure the qualities of individuals and populations. Galton was a cousin of Charles Darwin, and he developed statistics in order to apply Darwin's theories of natural selection to a human population. He was trying to determine, in other words, who would qualify as an acceptable or normal, and who would not, so that the people who didn't make the cutoff could be eliminated. He called this new science of social engineering, and the word normal he used to achieve it, eugenics. Next. We have forgotten that eugenics was wildly popular in American culture. Many famous people belonged to eugenics clubs and organizations, and there was great enthusiasm for its cleansing potential. To a considerable degree, the thinking behind Hitler's Mein Kampf was adapted from Anglo-American eugenics and its new science of statistics at the end of the 19th century. Eugenics was so mainstream that it became a part of American popular culture in the first half of the 20th century. The Kansas State Fair in 1920 featured the Fitter Family Contest. Winners had to submit a eugenic family history, proving to have no physically impaired relatives, and pass intelligence tests. It was a celebration of genetic selection rivaled only by the livestock competition, which it was supposed to supersede. And in Kansas, it doesn't get bigger than that. And the slide up right now shows a family on the left-hand side, underneath the title Fitter Family Contest, a blue ribbon in the middle, and a cow on the right-hand side. Next slide. Eugenics, everyone thought, promised progress. As the president of the University of Wisconsin said in 1918, we know enough about eugenics so that if the knowledge were applied, the defective classes would disappear within a generation. Next. At that time, the defective classes he wanted to eliminate included an incredible diversity of people all thrown onto one list. The blind, the deaf, hemophiliacs, anyone with a birth defect or a serious disease like tuberculosis, along with diabetics, alcoholics, and the poor. It took Hitler to give eugenics a bad name and knock it out of us. But it's not all gone. Next. What we're left with and haven't gotten rid of yet is this concept of normal, which has colonized our thinking. We still unconsciously use eugenics' basic scheme of dividing people into two categories, the normal, who are acceptable, and the abnormal, who are not. We associate the word normal with words like whole, natural, moral, good, appealing, competent, independent, able, and us, hopefully. We associate abnormal with words like less than, incompetent, morally suspect or weak, unappealing, compromised, disabled, and hopefully somebody else. Next. So normal is now like a well-behaved German Shepherd attack dog sitting in our living rooms. If you stay normal, he'll stay nice. But as soon as you're in danger of being categorized as too different from the norm or abnormal, he'll turn on you. Next. Here's what that can look like. I interviewed an 80-year-old woman named Emily for my dissertation. Emily was born in 1922, 2 years after the Kansas State Fair Fitter Families Contest. Like her peers, she grew up on a steady diet of mainstream eugenics ideology, sort of like we grew up on McDonald's. She now has very low vision from AMD. When I asked her if she sees herself as having a disability, she said, no, absolutely not, not yet. Next. When I asked her why not, she said, because I want to think of myself as a whole person. When you're disabled, you're not a whole person. Well, I think Hitler would agree with that. That's not common sense thinking. That's eugenics. Big alarm bells need to go off in our heads whenever we start calling people, and especially ourselves, not whole, because we don't perfectly fit some master model of a human being. Next. We can see the legacy of this concept of normal in the way we talk about people with disabilities. In Henry Grunewald's book, Twilight, which recounts his experience with AMD, he talks about attending an award ceremony for people with disabilities who have achieved distinction in their professional lives. He writes, quote, "The spirit they displayed in surmounting their disabilities was deeply moving and caused me to think about the handicapped. I had always considered them a group apart. It was not easy for me to accept that I was one of them," end quote. Well, if you always think of people with disabilities as a group apart, it is really hard to accept that you're one of them. But why all this group apart stuff to begin with? Why divide the world into us and them? That's not common sense. That's a legacy of eugenics. Next. It also doesn't represent the way that people who have lived with disabilities all their lives actually experience the world and see themselves. One of the recipients of the Achievement Awards at the event Grunewald was attending was Kara Dunn, a blind attorney and skier. Here's what she said when she accepted her award for overcoming her handicap. Quote, "If you offered me sight right now, I would tell you to give it to someone who felt it was something they could not live without. I don't think the things I need to be able to do are things that can't be done without sight." End quote. I don't think she was saying this because she was being heroic. I think she was just being honest. I think that it comes from a lifetime of experience living without vision as being a completely normal thing to do for her. From her perspective, you don't need sight to live a full life. And all Grunewald's talk about the handicap as a group apart is something he's bringing to the table. It's not how she sees herself. If you asked her what she really had to overcome, I suspect she wouldn't say it was her blindness. She would say it was other people's attitudes towards it. Next. Georgina Klieg, who has low vision, from the juvenile form of macular degeneration, makes the point more bluntly. She writes in her memoir, Sight Unseen, quote, "The most valuable insight I can offer is this. Blindness is normal to me." Now, I know that losing vision doesn't feel normal if you've had vision for most or all of your life. I'm not trying to say that everyone needs to think of their vision loss as a normal experience. But rather, wouldn't it be nice if we didn't use normal to categorize people in ways that have more to do with our own cultural legacy of eugenics than it has to do with anyone's actual lived experience of being a person in the world? Next. Before normal, before statistics, before eugenics, we had two categories for bodies, for thinking about bodies in Western thought: the ideal and the grotesque. The ideal were the gods, who had such physical perfection that no living person shared, because no one has a truly perfect body. The grotesque was the rest of us. We are all grotesque at various times and in various ways during our lives. We are all part of the big gamish of humanity and all its biodiversity and life experience. And nobody has a perfect body. Next. Perhaps if we become aware of our addiction to normal and our intolerance of what we label abnormal, we can let it go. We can kick the attack dog out of our living room and live fully as we are, as we are at home and in our communities. Next. In our book, Macular Degeneration, The Complete Guide, we don't talk about this word normal, but we do have lots of vignettes and stories about people with low vision who have let it go. We wish we had time now to share some of those stories with you, but we'll leave them for another time. So I will close by saying, don't let normal tyrannize you. You are not your eyes, and you are not your sight. Your value to yourself, your loved ones, your community, and our society does not wane with fading eyesight. And what you can do is not defined by your visual acuity. Most of all, as someone who is younger, I want to say that we need you. We look to you to see how to handle being older and losing vision, because we are right behind you, and many of us will lose vision too. It's one thing to talk about low vision. It's another thing to really experience it. I can talk, but you have lived and experienced. So you are our role models for how we live fully now as ever. Thank you.
Lilas and Maria, that was a very inspiring talk. It was just full of philosophy and all kinds of things to think about. And we're going to have about 15 minutes here for people to ask questions, make comments of any kind. And the way we'll do that is the way we did last month, and that's for you to type in your question into the message area. And we'll take those in turn and have address them to either to Lilas or Maria, or just an open question or comment, and we'll let these ladies take over. While we're waiting for some questions to appear, Dr. August Kallenbrander, who I've been working with on a project here recently, which has to do with the terminology we use for people who are vision impaired, visually impaired, or low vision, has said that, and I think he's quoting someone else, but he has said that more people are blinded by definition than they are by disease. And I wonder what you think of that that comment. I like the way that's said, and would either one of you like to make a comment on that? More people are blinded by definition than by disease.
Yeah, that was made by Lloyd Greenwood in the 50s in response to the legal blindness business of, you know, the 2200 as legal blindness. And he said, you know, more people are blinded by definition than by any other cause. I think it's a great comment.
Somebody wrote to me from Australia the other day and said we have a problem when we go across international boundaries in understanding the positions that every different culture has. Marja hit upon that. He said that I think it was his brother-in-law was trying to come up with a good symbol for Vision Australia. And they thought maybe the owl would be a good one because it's wise and all-knowing. And then they discovered that in one country, and I don't remember which country it was, the owl is considered a symbol of death. So they thought maybe we shouldn't use that. There was another example he gave was Gerber baby food had a problem when they first introduced their baby food to Africa. They were putting that picture, that cute little baby on the cans. Of course, we are all familiar with that, but in Africa, they have a habit of putting the picture on the can of what's in the can that they're intending to eat. And so there was a huge problem with that. And so we run across things like this, too, between cultures. And where it really becomes important is when we run across it between people, people in our own situation. We have to be able to understand one another and understand these definitions and the meanings of the word handicap and disability and impairment that you so clearly outlined for us. In other words, we are not handicapped. We may have a handicap, but we are not handicapped except by possibly conditions or by other people's attitudes. And that's what I took from this. And I want you to let me know if I did understand that correctly. In other words, are we're not disabled. We have a disability. Is that basically what we're trying to get at here?
Dan, yes, exactly. That you may have a physical impairment, but that doesn't mean you have a disability. It depends on the environment. And we can even say that, we can think about it with able-bodied people, too. Many of the women out there know that when men go to design a home or a kitchen, they often put shelves too high up on the wall and we can't reach them. Well, then we have to use a tool like a stepladder to get up there. So that's an example of an able-bodied person being disabled by the environment because they're not tall enough. So you have to use a tool to get done what you want to do. And it's the same thing with vision loss. You might have a visual impairment, but it's what's going on in the environment that's going to play a big role in what you can actually do. And that's why vision rehabilitation is so important. And it's also why it's really important to realize that the problem is not with you. The problem, if anything, has to do with what's going on in the environment, too. And the same is true with people's attitudes.
Now, an example of what Marja just said is if you are visually impaired in New York City, you basically do not have a disability for transportation, a handicap for transportation. That very same person, if he lived in Detroit, would have a big handicap for transportation because there's no public transportation. I see the question on the screen about the book being on tape, and it is on tape through the Library of Congress Talking Books program. It is not on tape commercially because in spite of all of our begging, the publisher refused to put it on tape, but you can get it through the Library of Congress.
I've had the same issue with my publisher on my book. It's difficult to get them to not think commercially. There's a need for talking books. Fortunately, the government has stepped in with that project. We've got a couple more questions up here on the board. Presbyterian Home says, do you have any advice to older adults living in retirement communities where they cannot always control the environment?
Yes. Many retirement communities are happy to make some adjustments. They just have no idea what they might be. Many places have all white kitchens, for example, counters white, everything white. If you think in terms of lighting, glare, and contrast as the big three, and just look around your living environment and say, okay, whenever, whatever task you're doing, you need lighting. Whatever you're trying to do, what is the contrast? So, for example, if you're doing something on your kitchen counter, if you're chopping an onion, for example, put a black cutting board underneath it. If you have white kitchen cabinets, for example, and white walls, when you open the kitchen cabinet, you might not be able to tell whether the door is open if it was the same color as the wall. If you put a colored strip along the inside of the bottom of the cabinet, that would help. Our occupational therapists have actually done some environmental assessments of both senior centers and residential centers. And I would be happy to send some of the photos and maybe some of the text to Dan of those as just helpful strategies for making your environment better. We often talk to the administrators of senior centers or retirement communities, for example, in their dining rooms so that there won't be glare, that's the disabling glare coming in from windows in the dining room, and that if they have white tablecloths and white dishes, and that they will vary that and put dark placemats under the white dishes, that sort of thing.
Yeah, those are all good tips. And if the retirement home has problems outside of your own environment, your own apartment, such as steps that you can't see because maybe the edges are blending in with one another, then you have every right to go to the directors of the home and make a polite request that be taken care of. If you need to go even further than that and be a little stronger with it, the ADA will be very helpful in that area as well. We only have a few minutes left here, and I wanted to address another question up here. Kidron Bethel says, what is the relationship between cataracts and AMD? We have a member here who's been told that having her cataract out could adversely affect her AMD.
With regard to cataracts and AMD, the jury is out to some degree. There have been some studies to suggest that if you already have wet AMD, that cataract surgery might exacerbate that. So ophthalmologists are often reluctant now to do cataract surgery on someone with wet AMD. And other studies have demonstrated no such relationship if you have dry AMD, and yet another one recently found no association with wet or dry. So it's not absolutely crystal clear at this point, but there remains a suggestion or a suspicion or some level of probability that it may exacerbate wet AMD.
I think the general answer, which you agree with, I'm sure, is that if you don't have to have the surgery done, don't. Just because even if there's a small risk that it could lead to wet AMD or a more serious condition, then it's just not worth it, unless that cataract is just so significantly impairing your vision that it wouldn't make any difference. Then I would leave it well enough alone, and I think most doctors agree with that. Is that right, Lynn?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And actually, there was another study out of Australia where they found that cataract surgery at any time in your life increased your risk of AMD. So it wasn't that cataract surgery when you have it makes it worse, but you know, if you have it when you're 60, you may be more likely to get AMD when you're 85. So you know, at any time. So there really is some suspicion in that regard.
I think we've had an outstanding session again today. We've just been real fortunate these last few months to just really have some top-notch guests. And once again, I want to really plug the Moak book. It's the best book out there on the market, and I can say that because I think mine is second best. And so we said the other day our two books ought to be glued together because I think they really complement one another. And I'm very grateful to Lilas for writing the foreword for my book. And so go out there and get both of those books. You're going to learn just about everything you need to know with the combination of them, if I may be so unhumble as to suggest that. So thank you again, Lilas and Maria. We hope you'll come back again because I'm sure you didn't say everything that you could have said today, and we'd love to have you back if you're willing to do so.
We'd be happy to come back. We enjoyed it. I can speak for myself. I enjoyed it a lot. I'm sure Maria did too. Thanks for your nice comments on the book, and I think that our book is a great adjunct to your book. I think they are a terrific combination. Thanks.
I wanted to say thank you, too. I really appreciate you having us, and I would always really be honored to be able to come back. Thanks again.
Okay, we're getting a lot of nice reviews up there in the text window. I appreciate all your nice comments. I hope to have a lot of information for you next month, in addition to Tom Persky's presentation from the Academy of Ophthalmology meeting in Las Vegas. So we're off to that next week, and we'll see you in December. Thank you all for coming again.